Les colloques du Collège de France.
Hi everyone, welcome back for this second day of the Discourse Files workshop. As our first speaker today, it's our great pleasure to welcome Barbu Ravenku, who's now based here at Collège de France, who's a cognitive scientist, developmental psychologist, and also one of our organizers. Barbu, go ahead.
Hello, good morning. Can you hear me well? Okay. Michael, make me a sign if I go too far from the mic. So my plan for today is to try to convince you that symbolic relations develop early in human cognition, and I'm going to do this by first giving an overview of what I mean by Stanford relations in cognition and communication. I'm going to then show you empirical work that I did to find evidence for these relations in infants, and then I'm going to move to a discussion of Stanford relations in toddlers, where I think the evidence is pretty very strong. I will introduce depictions by making a detour through European football. And when people learn about this sport, the most difficult concept that they struggle with, actually the only difficult concept that's more difficult to grasp, is the offside rule, which is defined as follows. Players are offside if they're closer to the opponent's goal line than both the ball and the second last opponent. Now, this sentence is difficult to parse even if you already know what offside is, let alone if you don't. And when this happens, people spontaneously turn to alternative forms of communication. So here, for instance, is a bird's eye view of a table with bottles arranged on it to illustrate the offside rule in a much better position. So in this setup, the green team attacks, and their objective is to bring the ball into the net on the left. And because the leftmost attacking player is behind the leftmost defender, he's in an offside position and cannot play the ball if he receives it in this position. Now, let me also take this opportunity to note several noteworthy properties of this setup. So, first, in this depiction, bottles convey information about football players. So when a bottle is being manipulated, what's being conveyed is something about the player that the bottle stands for, not about the bottle. For instance, that this guy is no longer offside. Second, the relations between the bottles and the players are local. You do not want to generalize this relation outside of this communicative episode, because beer bottles are not players, obviously, but also beer bottles are not conventional symbols thereof. Third, the relations between the bottles and players are stable within the episode once they're stipulated, so it would be infelicitous to start using one of the bottles as the referee after having stipulated that it stands for a defender. And fourth, the football players that the bottles stand for need not exist. So I didn't have any particular footballers out there in the world in mind when I generated this example, and I also suspect that you haven't been asking yourselves while following this example which particular footballers do these bottles stand for. Now, how should we think about this relation? So, because bottles convey information about football players, I think it's reasonable to call them symbols. But symbols of what? Usually symbols are discussed as standing for reference, but this doesn't apply here because, again, the reference carries the connotation that the things that the bottles stand for are to be found in the world, but this is not the case here. And for this reason, and also very fittingly for this conference, I argue that what's the second relatum are better thought of as discourse reference for multiple reasons. So first, as has been repeated multiple times yesterday, they are not existentially committing, so discourse reference don't really care whether the objects exist in the world or not. Second is the discourse reference provide a representational format for individuating the entities under discussion, allow us to track them as the discourse unfolds and accumulate information about them, and also internal coreference in language. This is achieved by means of pronouns, for instance. Now, this is analogous to our example here, because the football players needn't have a correspondent out there in the world, yet we do individuate them to and accumulate information about them as the communicative episode unfolds. And there's also coreference, not by means of pronouns, but by means of manipulating or pointing to the previously introduced bottle. So I'm going to close this relation by saying that in depiction, symbols stand for discourse reference. And this exact same setup is not limited to setups containing real objects, but can also be found in diagrams and even in realistic photos. And moreover, this exact same setup appears in many guises across human communication, ranging from dynamic movies and theater plays, where actors stand for characters, in puppet shows, in animations, mistake on my slide, where pixel constellations stand for fictional characters, in graphs, and also in assembly manuals. Now, this ubiquity of depictions across human communication points to a cognitive mechanism that is optimized for interpreting them. And based on what I've said before, I think we should think of this cognitive mechanism as consisting of two sets of mental representations. On the one hand, an object layer that tracks the symbols in space and time with object indexes, and a discourse referent layer that tracks the entities under discussion. Now, note that just representing the objects and the discourse referent separately would not allow one to know which symbol stands for which discourse referent. So we need one function, I call it assignment, that provides internal pointers from each symbol to its corresponding referent. We also need a tokening function, again, because in the offside example I started with, the football players need to be generated from the conceptual system through an operation such as the one that Alan suggested yesterday, for instance. And note that depictions are hybrid representations. So you have on the one hand symbols that stand for objects, but the relations among the objects are not encoded in symbols themselves, but in the spatial relations among the symbols. And so we need another function that can convert the spatial relations among the symbols into semantic relations holding among the discourse referents. But today I'm going to focus on the assignment function that provides pointers from symbols to discourse referents, as this defines the stand for relations. And I'm going to only indirectly address the second point. And in the remainder of the talk, I'm going to present the first study that we did on this topic, showing a proof of concept that depictions are worth investigating in infants. I'm going to then present more direct evidence for the availability of stand-for relations in early cognitive development. And then I'm going to move on to discuss pretend play in this framework that I've just presented. So the first step in this research program was to try to find evidence that depictions are worth investigating early on in development, and I'm introducing this in this way because there is plenty of evidence that toddlers struggle with depictions until they're about 2-3 years of age. And this is an extensive body of work by Judy Deloach and colleagues. showing that so using tasks that run as follows. So there's a real room, and then the experimenter hides a toy in that room under the chair. So there are multiple possible occasions for that, and then toddlers are shown via depiction. So here, for instance, a scale model where the toy is hidden in the real room. By placing an equivalent, so there's a big Snoopy that's being hidden in the large room, and there's a small Snoopy that's being hidden in the scale model. And until they're about 2-3 years of age, toddlers do not pass this task, and their failures are quite striking. And this holds not only for scale models but for pictures and videos as well. But on the other hand, one type of depictions, namely schematic animations, is routinely used in developmental studies, and we know from many, many experiments that infants do interpret these stimuli. So this is a famous study showing that infants expect moving balls to take the shortest path towards the goal. So if you remove this obstacle, infants expect this ball to go on a straight line to the big ball. And they also interpret more complex social interactions, also based on very schematic animations. So there is this tension here, because on the one hand, there's evidence that infants struggle with depictions. On the other hand, some of the depictions they process fluently. And now the question is how can we solve this tension? So on the one hand, it's possible that infants just don't perceive animations as depictions. Namely, they think they take them as continuous with reality. They just have a transparent and naive view of them. And the second is that animations are interpreted as depictions early on. Now, I've just said that they struggle with interpreting depictions based on the evidence from the scale model experiments. However, it's possible that what infants do is interpret animations as depictions, but just are unable to link them to real-world states of affairs. And to test this, we just wanted to know whether for inference animations are spatio-temporally continuous with the world. And we did this as follows. So first, we designed a baseline experiment that ran as follows. We built a seesaw that could, so there's a ball here and there's a seesaw, and the seesaw could be inclined from behind the curtain, left or right, so that the ball falls into one of these two boxes. And then we asked infants, where is the ball? And so what I'm gonna show is accuracy on the y-axis, and by accuracy I mean choosing the same box, choosing the box on the same side as the falling event. And 50% means chance in this case. And as you can see, in this very simple baseline condition, infants are successful in tracking the ball into the boxes. And after the sanity check, we ran the crucial condition, which was a crossover condition in which the animation was on screen and the boxes were below the screen. And here the question was whether infants would expect that the animated ball would end up in the boxes below the screen. And they did not. They were actually perfectly at chance when they pointed to one of the boxes. And in fact, we also had the, so infants also pointed to the center of the screen a lot of the times when asked where the ball is, suggesting that there's no, they don't think that that what happens on the screen continues outside the screen. And this was not because of some feature of the animation, because when the boxes were also moved back on the screen, infants were again back at ceiling. Okay. So it's not because infants do not think that animations are continuous with reality, but still that doesn't mean that they interpret animations as depictions, because it could be that infants have just learned that screens have rigid boundaries that don't allow objects to pass through, namely that they behave a bit like aquaria, like fish tanks, where Keep everything that's happening contained. And in the last experiment of this study, we wanted to look at this hypothesis. And this is the most baroque experiment I'm going to show, so please bear with me for a little bit. So the setup was as follows. There was a table, and we had two screens placed on it. A yellow screen and a red screen, and the screens had different backgrounds and an identical house in the center, and in the kitschy sci-fi background on the left, we showed infants a bear entering and exiting a house, and then in the wintry landscape on the right, we showed infants a rabbit entering and exiting its house. And then we made sure that infants know which animal lives on which screen. Then we covered the screens with curtains. We realigned them vertically. And then we uncovered the curtains and asked infants, where is the bear or where is the rabbit? And so this is a control condition because nothing funky is happening here. And so infants are very good at pointing that the bear is on the screen on top. And now in the experimental condition, so again, remember the fish tank hypothesis states that infants should not think that screens allow objects to pass through. So the setup was the same, except when we covered the curtains and realigned them, we surreptitiously swapped the background of the two screens, and now the question is on which screen will infants think that the bear lives, on the one on top where it was before, or on the one on the bottom where the one that has now has the same background. And indeed we find that infants go for background and not for physical location in this case, suggesting that they do not treat screens as aquaria. So this first study indicates that the findings of the first study are compatible with an early depiction concept because infants first decouple the animations from the surrounding environment, and second, they also decouple the animations from the screen on which they're presented, and they understand the depicted contents of animations. However, what they can't do is they cannot yet link the animations to the to particular real-world states of affairs. Now, I'm saying here that the findings are compatible with an early depiction concept because this study had a Popperian logic. We did not directly test the depiction account, but just set up a set of alternatives and went after them by falsifying them. So in the next study, we wanted to test more directly whether infants have access to these relations between symbols and discourse reference. And we derived three accounts from our, three predictions from our Stanford account. First, that infants will accept even arbitrary objects as ad hoc symbols. Second, that they will restrict the relations between the symbols and the discourse reference to the discourse in which they have been stipulated. And third, that they will interpret the events involving the symbols as information about the corresponding discourse reference. So in experiment one, we just wanted to check whether infants can map just arbitrary visual objects to familiar discourse reference. And the study ran as follows. We showed infants displays such as this one, consisting of two geometric shapes, left and right of the screen. And then one of the shapes was pointed to and labeled with a familiar noun, such as a dog. And then we had two trial types, same word trials, in which the infants heard a question, such as where is the dog, that contained the same noun that was presented during the labeling phase. And different word trials where infants also heard a familiar noun, but one that they haven't heard before in the experiment. And our prediction was, of course, that they would look at the green cross in same word trials, but not in different word trials. Now, before moving on to the results, I just want to add some more information about the design. So infants, before the experimental trial, the four experimental trials with geometric shapes, we also gave them four familiarization trials, which had an identical structure to the experimental trials, except showed object photographs instead of geometric shapes. So for instance, infants were shown a photo of a car and a ball, and then the car was labeled, and then we asked them where's the car or where's the ball. And we did this to familiarize infants with the procedure and also to make sure that they connect the voice that was coming from the speakers to the events on the screen. And after the experimental trials, we also did a vocabulary check because we needed to make sure that infants know the labels that we use to stipulate the identities of the shapes. So this again was similar to the other trials, except there was no pointing and labeling phase. We just showed them a dog and a cup and asked them, for instance, where's the dog? And we did this for all the words that we use to stipulate the identities of the shapes. Okay, so moving on to the results, again, these are the experiment. I'm going to start with the experimental trials, and this was an eye-tracking study, so what we measured was where infants look at the screen in response to the test question. So I'm going to show you the looking at the labeled object averaged over the 3.5-second measurement period, where 0.5 means equal looking at the two objects, 1 means looking at the green cross in this example, and 0 means looking at the distractor object, which is the one that was not labeled. And so, as we expected, infants looked at the green cross in Seymour trial, the labeled object in Seymour trials above chance, but not in different work trials. And these results were similar to what they did in the training phase. They did not map this green cross to the familiar nouns because they didn't understand the nouns, because in the vocabulary check we showed that infants know the meanings of these nouns. So what experiment one shows is that infants can map an arbitrary shape to a familiar noun. But of course, it doesn't show that they interpret them as symbols, because there are multiple accounts that can explain this data as well. So the first account is just recategorization. Despite appearances, infants learn from the labeling event that the green cross is a dog. Second, infants may infer that dog is a homonym that means both dog and cross. So under this account, they create a new lexical entry for dog that has a second meaning. And note that unlike Stanford relations, which are local, both of these hypotheses are global in the sense that infants learn either something new about the world, namely that the green cross is a dog, or something new about language, namely that dog has a second meaning. So we tested this hypothesis in experiment 2, where we tested this local versus global property. So experiment 2 was very similar to experiment 1. One of the objects was labeled, except now we also had a speaker manipulation. So we had the same speaker block in which the same speaker does the stipulation and asks the test question. This is a replication of experiment 1. But we also had a different speaker block where one speaker does the stipulation, another one asks the test question. And here the prediction of the Stanford account is that they should not extend this relation across discourses, where we index discourses by speakers. And whereas on the other hand, if they learn that the cross is a dog or that dog has a second meaning, then it shouldn't matter who asks the test question. And the training results and the vocabulary results look the same. So let's look at the experimental results. So in the same speaker condition, infants looked at the labeled object above chance only on same word trials, and there's a difference also between the same word trials and different word trials, whereas in the different speaker condition, they are at chance in both trials. So they do not generalize the stipulation between the cross and the dog to a different speaker. So it's not because they recategorize the green cross as a dog that they do the mapping, nor is it that they create a new lexical entry for dog. However, while experiment two indicates that this relation between the shape and the noun is local, it still doesn't. There are still available hypotheses that can explain the results. So, on the one hand, maybe the infants take the speaker to be idiosyncratic, to have their own particular vocabulary, such that they believe that. That the cross is called dog, or on the other hand, they could have a misguided belief about the world, namely believing that the cross is a dog, and this is why they don't generalize this to the second speaker. And another possibility is what goes by the name of referential pact, where the speaker just uses dog like a proper name to refer to the cross in this episode. Now, In neither of these cases should infants have any dog-related expectations from the cross. But again, in the stand-for relation case, once the cross stands for a dog, then the information that is conveyed through the cross will be mapped onto the dog. So in experiment three, we built on the early developing distinction between agents and objects. And now we also showed infants displays of two geometric shapes, but this time both of them were labeled. One of them was given the label of an animate agent, such as a dog, and the other one was given the label of an inert object, such as a cup. And then again, we had two trial types, congruent trials, where the dog label shape moves towards the object label shape, and incongruent trials, where the object moves towards the animal, and it's incongruent, of course, because only animals can self-propel. And this was a looking time study. So what we measured here was, once the movement ends, how long infants look to the screen until they look away for two consecutive seconds, which is used as a measure of surprise or priming. As predicted, I'm going to show you looking times. What we found was that infants look longer at incongruent trials, or those in which the cup moves towards the dog. And there's no other way in which these results could have come about, unless once they mapped the shapes to the respective identities, they start interpreting what's going on in terms of them. So again, they did not take the speaker to have a false belief, nor did they infer that the speaker uses a dog like a proper name, because if dog was used like a proper name, then it would have been devoid of meaning. So stand-for relations between symbols and discourse reference emerge early and are easily accessible, as 15-month-olds accept arbitrary objects, geometric shapes, as ad hoc symbols. They know that the relation between symbols and discourse reference are local to the communicative episode in which they emerge, and they interpret the symbols in line with the discourse reference once the symbols are assigned to them. Now, in the last part of the talk, I'm going to move from infants to toddlers and argue that the early emerging and universal human behavior that is pretend play is best explained by these relations between symbols and discourse reference. So, to recap, the cognitive processes required to understand depictions, such as the one on the right. So first, you need to individuate the object symbols for spatio-temporal tracking. You need to be able to assign them to discourse reference. You need to accumulate information about the discourse reference based on the actions performed on the object symbols. And this is actually derived from the assignment relation. And finally, the assignment needs to be discarded once the communicative episode is over. And pretend play illustrates all of these processes because first toddlers choose the appropriate props for pretend action. So in a context in which there are two toys, a toy horse and a toy gorilla, and you tell toddlers that horses like carrots and gorillas like bananas, toddlers, when you tell them that one of the animals is hungry, they can correctly feed distinctively the blocks that have been stipulated to stand for carrots to the horse and the blocks that have been stipulated to stand for bananas to the gorilla. And moreover, toddlers also accumulate information about the discourse reference based on the actions performed on the object. So if the banana has already eaten the yellow one of the blocks, then toddlers refrain from feeding that block to the gorilla when the gorilla is hungry again, even though that block is still physically present. And they can also answer questions about the discourse reference, again, even though there's no perceptual way on which they could do that. So if an empty bucket appears in the scenario that the infant is asked to imagine contains red paint, and if the bucket is spilled over the horse, then if you ask toddlers how the horse looks now, they will choose the red horse on the left, even though the one on the right is identical to the perceptual horse that they have in front of them. And finally, toddlers discard the link once the communicative episode is over, and we know this because they don't generalize pretend identities to speakers who did not witness the stipulation, and they also accept multiple identities of the symbols across episodes. So for instance, the orange block could be a carrot in this episode, but then could be a bar of soap in a different context, and so on. This is of course not the only way in which in which pretend play has been explained, and while early developmental psychologists such as Piaget or Vygotsky talked about pretend play and explicitly discussed it in symbolic terms, later accounts have thought about pretense in a different way. So the first cognitive extended cognitive account of pretend play comes from Alan Leslie. And what Alan Leslie noted is that pretend play poses a problem because the ontological integrity of the cognitive system is threatened by the false representation that, for instance, the banana is a phone in a context in which the parent pretends that to use that the banana. So when the parent uses the banana as a phone, we don't want children to end up with phony representations about bananas. And so what Leslie suggested is that these representations need to be quarantined and proposed a decoupling operation with the content the banana is a phone that is just isolated from the primary representations about reality. Now, subsequent accounts went one step further and argued that actually the whole pretense episode needs to be quarantined so that toddlers don't learn that this banana is a phone, that bananas are phones, or that this phone exists. Now, this indiscriminate decoupling, the first problem with it is that it does not make a distinction between the format of pretense, where we want the symbol to be different to be kept separate from the discourse referent, and the content, because the pretense situation does not belong to the world. And now in the Stanford case, the relation between the symbol and the discourse referent is isolated, not because of the representation that is quarantined, the representation, the the banana is a phone, but rather is implemented in the architecture because there's a separate representation for the banana and a separate representation for the discourse referent. And second, if you decouple indiscriminately, then there's no way to explain why toddlers learn new things about the world from pretense. So toddlers should absolutely learn about this from communicative acts, something about phones in general, and probably this is why one of the functions of pretense. The second possibility started from the observation that toddlers do not understand representations as representations. They merely generate a mental representation with the content, the banana is a phone, and just act as if this representation were true. So the one problem with this account is that it generates, it is based on a false dilemma, namely, it doesn't follow from the lack of meta-representational awareness. The behavioral account doesn't follow from the meta-representational awareness, just as the early lack of meta-linguistic awareness, understanding words as words, does not imply that toddlers behave as if the word banana were a banana. And the second problem is that toddlers have no problem with pretense speech and sounds. So if you move a pencil on the table and say vroom vroom, toddlers have no problem understanding that the pencil stands for a car. But know that this is not what you would do if the pencil were actually a car. You would not make vroom vroom sounds. So this predicts that toddlers should find those contexts more difficult, right? Because they should find the closer the representation is to the reality, then the easier it would be to generate this as if representation. Another option that has been discussed in the literature is a proto-symbolic account. And the idea is that early pretense play is not fully symbolic because particulars cannot yet be represented. And this is again linking back to all the literature showing that toddlers do not understand that symbolic depictions can stand for real world state of affairs. And instead, what the toddler does is take the banana as a symbol of the phone kind. Now, the problem is that toddlers understand that different bananas represent distinct phones, which they wouldn't be able to do if a banana stands for a phone kind, because then the two bananas would have the same meaning, right? They would stand for the same thing. And second, toddlers ascribe predicates to the discourse reference that only apply to tokens, so the phone can be broken or the banana can be eaten. And this is so the property of being broken applies only to individual phones, not to the phone kind. And finally, some researchers have conceded that early pretense may be symbolic, but deny that the Stanford relation is a primitive, and instead argue that the relation between the banana and the phone is derived from language. Now, if it were derived from language, this does not explain why toddlers struggle with understanding Stanford relations involving ordinary reference, because by two years, when they do not pass the Deloach tasks, toddlers understand that linguistic representations refer to particular states of affairs. And the second problem is that there's not much evidence for an influence of language except temporal order. So language develops first, and then there's evidence for pretense second. But this is not very informative because language and pretense are not equated in multiple ways. So the toddlers and infants' experience with both of these is different. They have much more linguistic experience than experience with pretense. And second, pretense requires infants to understand that objects are symbols, and objects and words are not equated in their mind. In the sense, and what I mean by this is that objects activate several core knowledge systems. There's an internal competition early on, because objects activate multiple representational systems, whereas words do not. So it might take a longer time for inference to figure out that to apply the symbol concept to objects. However, I think the link between depictions and language is very much wide open, and I'm saying this because in sign languages there are classifier predicates that work a lot like depictions, so these are special constructions and special signs for which an iconic interpretation is obligatory. So there are sign languages in which there are two symbols for car, and one of them works like the word car, and another works exactly like a pretend object. So you assign you make the sign for car in space, and then when you move your hand, that means that the car went by like this. So to sum up, the Stanford account of pretend play offers a principled and also parsimonious explanation of this universal human behavior by placing it in the broader communicative and cognitive context of depictions. And it avoids redundant cognitive operations, some of which have been specifically postulated for pretense, such as decoupling. And it also explains how pretend play facilitates learning about the world. You have the relation between the symbols and the discourse reference, and then you can use whatever you learned about the discourse reference to generalize that information outside the episode. So, to sum up, and to conclude, depictions are ubiquitous in human communication, and Stanford relations between symbols and discourse reference are a central component thereof. The data I show to you suggest that Stanford relations are likely a building block of human cognition, and they also provide a straightforward explanation of pretend play. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have some time for questions. Please raise your hand if you have a question until I nod at you. Joseph.
Okay, well, thank you. Can I go back to the football game?
Yep.
Why do you, you explain with the bottles what offside means? Why do I have to, in order to understand this, think about that those bottles represent football players?
What's the alternative?
Well, I don't care. Those bottles are playing football, and I see when they are offside. I mean, let's say you are flying in a helicopter over a football field and you see those things, but they're actual football players, and you explain to me what offside is. I see not much difference in what I have to do mentally in order to understand what offside is.
So how do you map that information to football instead of just...
Because in football, whoever those... elements are, when this situation arises, it's offside.
Right, but is it, so once I say, okay, look at this defender, look at this attacker,
yeah,
how would you,
whenever playing football, then when this situation occurs, it's offside. That's what I learned, and that those things here don't have to represent football players. It's just that they represent a thing is on a field, and you demonstrate to me when the offside situation occurs. And this information I can use when seeing actual football players.
Okay, but... So I'm not sure that this is indeed an alternative, because it's it's clear that we don't think that bottles are playing football.
Yeah, but you are just explaining to me, if now I say they are playing football. And if they are playing football, then if this situation occurs, it's an offside. So the green one is trying to get the bottle cap into that goal there, and the other green is in front of the brown one, and
I think you're just trying to say there's nothing about the humans. You're trying to push that there's nothing about them being humans that
yeah.
is necessary to
right.
push you.
It's just that they are behaving like football players. Behaving according to the rules of football, that they are pushing this ball.
I don't think they need to be humans, but the fact that they are playing football is what's important here.
Yeah, okay, but why do I have to then see that this is a symbol for something?
It's a symbol just in the sense that there are two representations, one for the object, and one for this role they play in this situation, even if you don't want them
okay,
to
so
be
Okay, so when
humans.
You have actual football players, they have two roles, being entities and playing football.
When you have football players in the when you watch a game, you mean?
Yeah.
No.
Why?
Why would you have that? There's no communication there. You're just watching an event that is part of reality.
Okay. Of course, I have to make a context of what they are playing, but I don't have to. I have to know the rules of football, and if they are playing football, what they will be doing. And that's good enough. I don't have to say are those brown and green bottles that play football.
So I don't see how you'd avoid the category mistake unless you had two distinct representations.
Well, there is imagination is involved in any case. So, if you chose that suggestion, you're imagining.
We should use the mic, and also I think Nick has a follow up. Maybe for also a follow up? Okay, so multiple follow ups. So I guess we'll go to Nick first, and then maybe François and then Hans. If these are all fingers / follow ups.
I hope a quick follow up. Suppose this was just a game, suppose it was the game of Go. So it's something you do with counters, and you were explaining the game. Would that also require a stand for a count? I think one way of taking Josef's question is that we can just see this as a game that's being played with the bottles.
In what sense is the bottle example is the bottle situation a game played with, because the bottles don't have no agency or of their own, it's just manipulation. But I think that in the Go case something similar will be happening, but I think the next talk will be more about it.
So in connection with this question, to what extent there are two levels of representation, I wanted to try the following example out with you, because I thought I had understood. And it's the example of somebody who has watched football games and also watched field hockey games. Now, the offside rule for field hockey is quite different from the offside rule for football. It involves two players in it. Involves a circle around the goal of the opponent. And you can use exactly the same abstract representation to explain the offside rule for hockey. As you have just shown, you can use it to explain the offside rule for football. And I would have thought that this abstract way of representing what's going on in these two cases would be just the right, or at least a very good way, of explaining what offside means for these two types of games, for somebody who's actually watched the games but didn't quite understand why the umpire sort of interrupted because of offside in the two cases. And I would have thought that if you use this scheme to explain to this person both the offside rule for football and the offside rule for hockey, it would be natural for the recipient of the explanation to actually have, maybe remember particular scenes and generally have pictures of football games with actual players when you give the explanation of offside for football, and switch to representations of actual hockey games where you use this same scheme to explain offside for hockey. Am I right in thinking that that illustrates these two levels of representation that you are talking about? Yeah?
Yes. The fact that you can convey multiple, yes.
Yeah. So I was wondering, but that could be an answer to the question you were given.
Boy. I had a hard time understanding.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll explain later.
Okay.
Thank you. So I've been thinking about the football example from, like, I have the exact opposite intuition to some degree, that I feel like it has to be much more. Even as if you were explaining it to me, you were doing all sorts of counterfactual conditionals, that if it was here and not there, like, in order to really get the rule, I feel like you certainly need some type of symbolic relations, but the type of content that we convey from this seems to be sort of way beyond what just the Stanford relation alone gives to you. The type of content that we have to convey in order to get all the sort of the norms of football, or I don't know how to talk about it. So I've been wondering, when it comes to the pretense cases, whether you think that there are evidence in that domain for these types of things that you have to, for instance, think through multiple events and go back in time and restart the event in order to understand it, or think about like this sort of, if it was like this but it isn't, then this should happen type scenarios. So sort of more logically more complex scenarios.
Yeah, but you cannot set up these logical scenarios with depictions, only with depictions. You need language to introduce those kinds of operators. Now the question is whether you can generate them internally just by looking at that. I don't know.
No, that's not what
I just meant. Even with language, whether children play out such scenarios that we as adults would characterize having these complex structures or not.
When children play with it, so they are very poor at generating their own scenarios until relatively late. Their imagination is impoverished. They're, of course, like in language, much better at comprehension than production until, yeah.
So we had a question by Hans. Hans.
Oh.
Unless there was the follow-up.
Oh. Yeah, so this is, the question is about whether there's any difference between children of different ages or between children and adults when it comes to the acceptability. Sorry? Better like that? I'll start again. So it's about whether there is a significant difference between children of different ages and between children and adults with regard to how acceptable certain symbols or icons are as symbols or icons for certain things. So I could imagine, I don't think you mentioned this possibility, but that you actually set up a scene where you have a picture of a banana and you say, this is a telephone. And next to it, you have a picture of a telephone and you say, this is a banana. Now that's sort of perverse from my point of view, and I think from the point of view of most adults. But I wonder if there is actually a stage in child development where that matters far less than it matters to us. That's the question.
Yeah,
no, it's great. so, yes, I also get the preference for for iconicity, and it's there early on, but it's not clear what drives it. So many people assume that iconic relations are just easier than symbolic ones, and that may be true for performance issues rather than competence issues. It's just easier to keep the mapping instead of memorizing an arbitrary one. We did focus on arbitrary mappings because those are more convincing, right? Because in the iconic case, you could say, well, infants just believe that that is a dog if you show them a line drawing instead of a shape. But the iconicity effects that are present in early on in development come from studies which do this perverse thing that you mentioned, namely they do have the alternative symbol next to it. Or before, so in the familiarization phase, they play with an actual phone and then they measure whether they accept. So, yeah. So it's That's it could be a pragmatic effect rather than a pure effect of the relation of similarity.
Nick. I wanted to ask about the earlier studies. So it seemed like you were making a very strong argument for a stand-for relation in pretend play versus the other candidates. But I was just going to offer you a way of thinking of the earlier studies that's more continuous with the way they're normally thought of. So it's just a kind of object tracking thing that's going on. So another way of taking what you've shown is that there are certain limits on the way that infant object tracking works when it's found in screens. So it doesn't leap from screens to real boxes. That if you move screens around, then expectations might go with background rather than with the physical movement of a screen. But it's still all within a picture where what they're doing is object tracking, and then you can get like temporary information added to the object, like a sound that's been made in conjunction with it, or a word by a particular speaker that's been used in conjunction with it. So. I mean, of course, you know, I'm not expecting you to do like a universal test, but do you think there's some reason why we should really reject the kind of a lower level object tracking account and go for something with this richer stand-for relation in?
In which of the studies are you talking about? The screen study?
All of them. All of the 14 to 16 month studies. All of the early studies.
The one where we label the. Okay, so I think these are very different studies. So let's discuss them one by one. In the
can you
show the material again? Yes. So this is one. So in what sense is this object? I mean, what it shows under your explanation is that they don't track objects beyond the screen on which they're presented.
Well, they're not taking it to be the same object. Like, if you're asking about an object in the box, it's not that. Is there a reason for thinking?
Have you given them a reason for thinking why an object in the box could be the same object as the one that's tracked on the screen?
Well, no, but that's the whole point, that that they don't think that the ball can end up in boxes below the screen. However, as I mentioned, many infants, when you ask them where's the ball in the second condition, the crossover one, they point to the screen, which shows that they isolate the existence of the ball to the screen on which it's presented. And then on this study, so this goes against at least the prioritization of spatiotemporal information that's usually there with object tracking. So because in this case they don't go for the spatial continuity assumption. They can change based on the background rather than the location on which it was presented.
So then you're building in an assumption that the object tracking system ought to keep track of relations to the exterior of the screen. Okay, so there's an object tracking system. You say, assuming that the signature of the system is it should keep track to the relations of the exterior of the screen, this is where they should look.
Yep.
So my alternative hypothesis is, like, you're probing how that object tracking system works when things are happening on screens. You've broken a standard link, and then the children have to default to some other kinds of information. So it's just kind of, you are telling us something very important and interesting about how object tracking works, but it's not requiring a stand-for relation. It's telling us more about what the signature limits of this object tracking ability is.
That could be the case, and this is again only indirectly evidence in favor of the stand-for relations, if at all. So let me just. Indeed, it's against a specific version of the fish tank hypothesis, where spatial temporal information is prioritized. I agree. So let's go to the second study. This one. So in what sense do we study low level object representations here?
You've updated the object representation with something that you've heard, just as I know, you think of the multiple object tracking files where you
a label to. Why is it isolated to the speaker?
Well, there's two hypotheses on that. The labels sound different with the two different speakers, so it might be that you're assuming that they should generalize with the language. But if you're just updating an object file, maybe you're updating something that's more oral.
I see.
And there's another more methodological thing, which is I wonder whether you did get an interaction between speaker rather than just non-significant in one
case. So there's no interaction here. There's a three-way interaction with order, which is why we are replicating this experiment. So that's true. On the other hand, there is evidence that infants can generalize new labels across speakers at 12 months old, and that's not compatible with this.
Well, depends what they're doing. It depends whether this is something that's going on at the level of language, or it's just like adding something to the object. Now, this is going on too long.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to ask a couple related questions, hopefully quick, kind of about the connection with the stand-for with talk of discourse reference. So first, I was a bit confused or maybe unsatisfied with the argument you gave for how discourse reference are not existentially committing. So you had a sentence, she is drawing a unicorn. So I agree that this doesn't entail the existence of unicorns, but I think that's because the noun phrase unicorn here is applying to drawings, you know, and how exactly that works, I take to be a separate type thing. And of course, if I say unicorns don't exist, but a unicorn walked into the room yesterday, there's something odd about that. So I was just about confused. And then kind of relatedly, I guess wondering how you're thinking about discourse reference. So would you think in a dynamic semantics, discourse reference, appeal to discourse reference account of, say, of just a simple case, a man walked in, he sat down, do you think that the count of that, you have to say that a man, the indefinite a man, stands for discourse referent, and then as well as he, or do you think that the formal account would be better glossed as the noun phrase a man introduces a discourse referent, which he picks up? So I'm just curious what you're thinking about the stands for and discourse reference in the context of, you know, dynamic semantics, and then to see how maybe the similarities or differences between how you're appealing to them here. And that's kind of related to the first thing. Thank you.
So I'm not sure what to make of the of your intuition that a unicorn walked into a room is weird, because you, I mean,
I explicitly say unicorns don't exist, and then I say, and also a unicorn walked into the room yesterday.
Oh, so in that context.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. But the point there is just that these differences are invisible to language, right? So it's not, I can say once upon a time there was a unicorn, and then start referring back to it because once I've introduced it in the discourse, that was my whole point. And to your second question, I don't think a man stands for a discourse referent. I think it introduces them. But unlike words, which once you've extracted the information that they convey, you can discard them. Here, you need to maintain the representation of the object symbols because they need to be spatio-temporally tracked throughout time. I mean, over time, while the communicative episode lasts. And in that case, you need that representation to be there. This is.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on that point because I think I totally agree with your interpretation of this as evidence for stand-for relations, but I was a little worried about the terminology when you were saying things like a symbol stands for a discourse referent. And it seems like we want to be a little bit careful because, like, in these scenarios we're talking about, there's some bananas in the real world, right? And we're saying that we've made an agreement in this game or something to that will what I do with the banana you should take as being informative about what people can do with phones or something like that. But I think you said, we always have the lower level as well, right? So there's some sense at which we're aware there's a banana here. And then there's the communicative level where we're aware that I should take what's being done with the banana to be communicating about. But at the same time, my actions are responsive to it being a banana, and I'm not going to squeeze it the way I would a phone because the banana would squish, right? And so I think, like...
Squeeze a phone?
Well, I can put more pressure on the phone than I can on a banana. Or, you know, when you're using the bottles to move them around, I'm still conscious that they're glass and they could break, right? Yeah. So I take it when you use symbol just to describe that in this situation, like you're sort of defining symbol as when an object stands for something else, but I think it's a little bit off to say that the symbol stands for the discourse referent or that you need a pointer between the symbol and the discourse referent. It seems to me like you're using symbol as a label for what the object is doing in the situation, not you're not using symbol here to refer to the mental representation of banana, right?
No, I'm using, yes and no. So, no, symbol, the banana is the symbol.
Yes.
And
the object.
The
right?
object, yes. Mm-hmm. And it's represented with the object index, with some object indexing system
mm-hmm.
that tracks it in space. Because this is
right.
how information is conveyed.
Yes, but to say that you have a pointer, which is like a mental addressing between the symbol and the discourse referent, I think now is not is somewhat inconsistent, right?
So no, yeah. I mean from the symbol representation to the discourse referent, that's where the pointer is. From the object representation to the discourse referent.
But then what's the symbol representation is what I'm sort of asking because...
It's the representation of the banana.
But you have to, right? You're going to have the representation of the banana that where you're realizing this is still a banana and acting on it according to it, its identity as a banana, you're also going to have the representation of whatever happens with that banana. I'm now taking it communicatively to be telling me about phones. But so I think it's just terminologically, it's something I would say to think about is being clear about those different mental representations, because I think it's not, it's unambiguous to say just the symbol representation in the mind. Between whether is it the thing that tells you there's a banana there? It can't just be that, because that has to be connected into the actual action.
I'm not sure where the information that object is a banana, the symbol one, the one that's temporarily a symbol resides. I'm not sure it has to be in the same representation. Because I don't think we need to think of it as a banana at all. We just need.
It needs to be somewhere, right? It's not at the discourse level, right?
It needs to be somewhere, but it doesn't need to be in this indexing system that keeps track of, that tracks it in space. I think it's a very much open question, but yeah.
François.
Yes. So you have this redundancy objection to an alternative pretense account that you discuss in terms of decoupling, so we already talked about that. I think it's a bit unfair to some of the people who sort of talked about this, like you mentioned Nichols and Stitch, who have a possible world Barthes in addition to the belief Barthes and so on, and use that to account for pretense. I think in your system, you have something very much like that, because you have this system of imaginary representations that involves sort of discourse reference, are objects we imagine, and as you said yourself, they are not actual objects. So we have this capacity to entertain imaginary representations about possible states of affairs, and that plays a role in your account. Of course, there is much more in your account, but you do have that. So actually, in terms of that, you can also run an account of some of the facts that you. For example, Joseph suggested that we can simply say that in the football case, we imagine that those things are playing football, those things. So we're not taking the things to stand for other things. We take them to be themselves, namely bottles. But we imagine that they're playing football, and then we can describe what an offside is in those terms. So that would be an account that would also rely on this. There have been two representations. You objected that you need two representations. Indeed, you would have a representation of the actual state of affairs. They are not playing football, they are simply models. But you have also this imaginary state of affairs. And again, that's, I'm not saying that this would be an account of, and that maybe your account is better. I want to emphasize the fact that all these accounts, including yours, have this notion of a representation of an imaginary state of affairs. And that's obviously very relevant to understanding pretense, and that's what the people like Nichols and Stitch have been saying, and I think they're right.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I actually, the point that I didn't make today, but that I'm making in the pretense paper is that yes, that's very true, but that's not a pretense related problem. So that's a communication problem in general, because it holds for stories, jokes, anything that comes via language, and it's just not isolated to pretense. Yeah, that's yeah, and yeah.
Is there one last question? If not, we can thank our speaker.
Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.